there is a little book that has come out that gives a clue as to where he's ended up as a result of his research. It's very interesting because he is a physician and has done his research in a laboratory way, a very scientific way, and his other books document that. But this little book called Stress Without Distress tells where he ends up. And just to give you a clue, he said, "I myself have tried to follow the philosophy of earning my neighbor's love as best I could, and has made my life as a happy one. Let me frankly admit, in looking back, I realize that I have not always succeeded to perfection, but my failures were due to my own shortcomings, not to those of the philosophy itself. The inventor of the best racing car is not necessarily its best driver." So he comes out of his research of how to deal with stress with a very basic philosophy of life, and it's interesting to see how he gets there. So you might like to look at Stress Without Distress. Then a book called Holistic Medicine from Stress to Optimum Health by Kenneth Pelletier. That's Pelletier. He is one of the forerunners, people in the forefront today in the holistic health movement, and documents out of his own medical experience and applying the holistic medicine approaches to various life situations, the evidence that he has found for new approaches to both healing and to health. And so I can highly recommend this book as a very useful book. Both these are available over at the bookstore. There's a little cartoon floating around, and maybe pass it over here and I'll read it for everyone, for those who haven't had a chance to see it. Lucy slams the door, makes known that she's upset. She says, "Boy, do I feel crabby." And Linus says, "Maybe I can be of help. Why don't you just take my place here in front of the TV while I go and fix you a nice snack?" And he says, "Sometimes we all need a little pampering to help us feel better. See, I came right back. Here's a nice sandwich for you, some chocolate chip cookies, and a cold glass of milk. Now, is there anything else I can get for you? Is there anything I haven't thought of?" "Yes, there's one thing that you haven't thought of. I don't want to feel better." When we feel tense and stressed, there's a part of us that wants to feel that. And that is based on how we experience life, how we see life, and what it means to us. So it's not as though we don't want the tension, but it makes sense for us in some way. So if your body is doing something, ask, what is it saying by what it's doing? What is that tension in my shoulders? What is that rumbling in my stomach? What is the tightness? What is the feeling I have, the shortness of breath, about not daring to breathe, or whatever? So whatever you're noticing in your body, begin to look at it as a language and say, what's it about and how does it make sense for me? And you may not immediately catch on to that. It may not be very obvious, because a lot of the things that we sense in life don't at first make sense to us. One of the ways I say that, and this is somewhat of a clue, is that often we want our problems. That somehow in growing up, we learned how to get attention in a negative way. And sometimes our problems in life are getting attention in a negative way. Like a fellow who comes in for counseling and says, "You know, I can't stand it. My wife nags me all the time. I wish there was some way I could get her to stop nagging me." And he says, "You know, well, that's what I'm here in counseling for, is how do I get my wife to stop nagging?" And my reaction to that person is often something like this: "How do you get your wife to nag you?" And often he says, "What? What do you mean? I don't want her to nag me." He says, "What do you do that invites the nagging? How do you react that keeps the nagging going?" And then we go to work, and we begin to help him explore and begin to realize that he's half of that interaction. That if there's nagging, there's something going on the other side that invites it and works with it and keeps the whole ball game going. So that in that sense, we can begin to take responsibility for what's going on in our life because we're playing half the game. Even though oftentimes it's not what we think we want, there may be another part of us that wants it. Now that's somewhat about what I want to deal with today, because a lot of the way that we experience stress in our lives is dependent upon how we look at a situation. If a dog were to come running in here right now and just scramble around, some of you pull back. Others of you may reach out and want to pet the dog. Others of you might be disgusted with the dog for interrupting the class. I might think, get out of here, you're stealing my show. We might have all different kinds of reaction, experience that dog with various kinds of stress, depending on our past experience. I had a friend who was out jogging not long ago, and a dog nipped him in the back of his calf. My hunch is, right now he's a little cautious around dogs, because he didn't expect that. And so based on our experience and what we believe about dogs, we would each react differently. This thing is, a very basic process that we go through as we respond to stress. It's called a stress response model. First, there are the stressors in life. And we dealt briefly with those yesterday. Those situations that seem to be stressful to us, and they vary between us, but surely there are those situations that we experience as stressful, and there is something going on in the situation that does produce some of that stress. So that's the situation of stress. An example of that were the deer flies last week. I guess those of you who are here will know what I'm talking about. Evidently they were relentless in their attack. But then there are the filters with which we look at a situation. As Paul says, we look through a glass darkly, or we look through our particular beliefs and attitudes at a situation, and so none of us see the same situation, even though we're looking in the same direction, because we all see it with our own framework. When you go to see a movie, have you ever talked to someone after the movie, and they say, "Oh, wow, they remember this scene and that scene," and you think, "Gee, I didn't remember those, but what was important to me was this one and that one." And each one got something different out of the film. In reality, we all see a different movie when we look at it, go see a show, because of the filters that we have. Today, I want to look with you at the filters. Then, based on the filters, we make an interpretation of the situation and we choose a way of responding to it. And this then is what we refer to often as the fight-flight response, and we're going to talk tomorrow about fight, flight, or flex, an alternative to the fight-flight response that may be important for us to be aware of. And finally, what are the consequences that result as we choose a way of responding? And these consequences then are in terms of the kind of disruptions in our life, whether we can maintain our health, what are the ways that we can maintain health and effectiveness, maintain our relationships, so that as a result of the stress in life, we don't blow it in our many areas of life. This then is a way of responding to stress. Back at Harvard, 1943, they did an experiment. They prepared a speech that was about the New Deal. And in the speech, they made about half of the speech in favor of it and about half of the speech opposed to it. And then they selected two groups. Each group was easily identifiable, one as being very in favor of the New Deal and one as being very opposed to the New Deal. And they presented the same speech to both groups. And then they asked them what they thought of it. And predominantly, those that were opposed thought it was a great speech. And those who were in favor thought it was a great speech. Because they heard what they wanted to hear in the speech. We tend to see what we're looking for in a situation. So we shape what we see by what we're looking for. They did an experiment with a group of doctors, and they said, now, group A of these rats have been trained to run the maze. These were doctors in training, and group B have not been trained. And we want you to observe them running the maze and see which group makes the most mistakes. And they were training the doctors to be observant. And so they did the experiment, and afterwards, those taking the test said, well, it's obvious that those that weren't trained made many more mistakes than those that were trained. And then they said, well, neither group has been trained to run the maze. So they tended again to see what they expected to see. So it's in that sense that we tend to see what we're looking for. One that has been interesting for me is to read the Gospels in the New Testament and to read it from two vantage points, two kinds of filters. One filter that I grew up with was that Jesus' main concern was whether we were right or wrong. And so I would read it with that viewpoint, that what's most important in life is whether you're right or wrong. After all, he said, be ye perfect, even as your heavenly Father in heaven is perfect. And when you read it with that viewpoint, you interpret things in a certain way. Then I began to learn and hear that there was another way, that Jesus had another concern. He said, I came that you might have life and have it abundantly. You who have believed in me have passed out of death into life. That what Jesus was concerned about was aliveness or deadness. He's concerned whether we're really alive to all of life or whether we're dead. And when I read the scriptures with that kind of an eye, what is Jesus saying about what does it mean to be alive? It says some very different things to me. So our filters make a great deal of difference as we explore life. It makes a difference in how we experience and how we function. For instance, just that idea of concern for rightness or aliveness, can you see the difference that that would make in raising children? If your concern in raising children was to make sure they did the right thing all the time, that would be one kind of approach. If your concern was that they come to life and be the most alive, beautiful kind of people they could be, how that would shape what you would do in raising children. Now, have some of you seen a beautiful sunset that really, really impressed you? Who's seen a sunset like that? Okay, would you tell me a little what the sun did?
Well, it was so beautiful that the sun almost seemed to move, because it's over the water on Puget Sound, and when the sun went down behind the Olympic Mountains, the sunset just didn't stay. It was going all the time. The sun was moving.
Okay. Now, let me ask you, was the sun moving?
It seemed so.
It seemed so, right.
But it wasn't moving.
Now, you know that the sun wasn't moving, the earth was turning, don't you?
But it seemed that the earth stood still in the sun.
Yes, okay. Now, we tend to, although we know better, we have a kind of belief about that sun moving that affects what we experience. And we stand there, we kind of look and see, oh man, that beautiful sun setting there and letting go. And we experience it as a sun setting, even though we know differently. So these attitudes shape our experiences. And we're often not aware of how they shape our experiences. I was out driving one Sunday afternoon, and it was a unique day. I didn't have anything to do that particular Sunday afternoon, and I decided to go for a ride, and it was before the price of gas had gone up, so I was just out riding for the fun of it. And as I drove along, I came up to a stoplight, stopped, and as the light changed, I took off, and I was just kind of moving right along and kind of weaving a little bit in between cars, and I was really making good time. And moving right along and realizing that I was going to get there in good time, the only problem was I didn't have any place to go. And the incongruity of it all finally hit me. What am I doing? Here I am kind of racing along with no place to go. And I became very aware in that moment that there was something going on in my head that said, hurry up, hurry up. You have to hurry up and get there. And I became aware that there is a tape in my head that tells me when I start doing something that I'm going to have to hurry up. Where did I get that? Well, my father was very concerned about hurrying up to get things done. I think my mother probably said it too, but my most vivid image is my father out mowing the lawn, running. And seeing him coming home for lunch, he was in contracting work, so occasionally he would stop in for lunch, and watching him inhale his lunch as he came through. And watching him approach things with a sense of hurry up. So what became apparent to me is if you're going to make it in life, you better hurry, because there's not going to be enough time. And I became aware now, when I start to do a job or a task or something, there's often that feeling. And when I walk, I'm aware of it. My shoulders go up. Hurry up. Hurry up. Get there. I have a way of holding my body that represents the hurry up. And a certain kind of tension, a certain kind of anxiety. And I go through life that way. In fact, I not only think that I have to hurry up, that there's not going to be enough time, I also start late enough, wait until it's so late, so I have to hurry. And I prove that you have to hurry through life, because after all, if I didn't hurry, I wouldn't get there in time. And I prove it over and over. And so I make it come true. Now, can you see how that creates a stress for me? When every job I start doing, everything I'm doing, I hear this tape and I start hurrying up. It's in that way that I have a filter that affects everything I do. It affects the way I relate to my kids, my family, everything. Now, there are other kinds of messages that you may think of. Our parents gave us different messages. And this is not Get Parents Week, but it's the question, how did I learn? And how has that become a part of me, and what can I do about it? These are the drivers that I'm referring to. Hurry up is one. How many of you had your parents tell you to try hard? You're not trying hard enough. Susie, mother says, Susie, go in and clean your room. Susie goes in and cleans the room. Comes out, says, okay, Mommy. And mother goes in and says, Susie, there's dust under the bed and you didn't do this. Susie, you're not trying hard enough. You have to try harder. Okay, next day, Susie, go clean your room. She goes in, she does a little better. Next, mother comes in and says, Susie, well, that's a little better, but your bed isn't quite made and this isn't quite done. And Susie, you aren't trying hard enough. You have to try harder. And another day, and the same kind of message, you need to try harder. And so finally, Susie begins to hear mother. You know, it takes a while for kids to hear mother. And so, Susie, go in and clean your room. Susie goes in and says, oh, boy. Boy, that was really rough. She comes out, and mother says, oh, boy, you're really trying hard. And Susie begins to learn that what's important is to look like she's trying hard, not getting the job done. And this is the kind of person that goes on through life where you just feel the heaviness of things that they do, because they're always trying hard. Everything feels hard to them. Whatever task they're doing feels heavy. And they often let us know, who are around them, that it was really a rough day. I really tried hard today. But often, they don't succeed or don't complete the task because they put more of their energy in the trying hard than in the succeeding, and all the strain and stress that goes with that. You know someone like that? Be perfect. Any of you have that message? This is one where you come home with a report card and you get a 90, and mother says, "Well, that's fine, but see, if you did some more studying, you could get 100. And the person comes home and gets 95. Well, that's fine, but if you did a little more studying, you could get 100. So that the focus is always on what's wrong. And that person then can get a 98 on an exam and says, "Woe is me, I only got 98. And they can look at someone else and say, "You got 90, isn't that great?" But when they look at it for themselves, they always see what's wrong and never feel like they can feel good about what they've done because it wasn't perfect. In one sense, we can say they always are looking at the half a glass of water as being half empty, rather than seeing that it's half full. So it becomes a way of looking and a way of approaching, and again, a way of feeling like you never make it, and always the pressure of that. Talk to a, we'll get into that. The be strong. This often is said to boys, but it's said a little differently to girls. To boys it's said, be strong, don't show your feelings, don't show any weakness. Don't cry, don't let on that you're really having any problems, always look strong. To girls it's often said, there's a kind of be strong, but it's like smile your way through, be attractive, or always smile, and never look like you have a problem, never let anyone know what's going on inside of you. So it negates the feelings. And one then sits on the feelings and never lets them show. It kind of spends a lot of energy and a lot of stress in terms of holding feelings. The please, I'm going to skip be responsible here, be more than others. Is the feeling like whatever you are, you're not enough. And the way you know that you're not enough is because someone else is better. And so people have told me that whenever they see someone better, they feel threatened because somehow they need to be better than anyone else. The please me message. Now, mother doesn't say this, but the message comes through. If you want to make it in life, just please me. Do whatever will please me. And so this person goes on through life trying to figure out how to please everybody else around them, how to keep everybody happy, how to solve everybody's problems around them, and keep everybody in good spirits. When I work with a person like this in counseling, I often ask them, "What do you want?" And they often respond, "I don't know." Have you ever been with a person where you say, we got a free evening tonight, what would you like to do tonight? "Oh, I don't know, what would you like to do?" "Well, maybe we could go to a movie." "Okay, that'd be fine. What movie would you like to go to?" "Oh, I don't know, what movie do you want to go to?" "Well, maybe we could go to this one." "Okay, that'd be fine. When should we..." "Well, I don't know, what do you want?" That no matter what you ask in terms of their being able to say what they want, they really feel like they don't have any right to want anything for themselves, that what they want is what will please someone else. And so that's a please me kind of message. Remember a fellow who came in who had this message strongly given him at home. And he then ended up with a job with a utility company in charge of the complaint department. And, you know, he was very successful at it because he knocked himself out to please people. The only problem was he had had a heart attack and he was ready to have another one if he didn't change what he was doing, because the stress of it all, trying to make everybody happy, was just beyond him. And because he felt like he had to make everybody happy or somehow he was a nobody, became a real heavy experience for him, resulting in, I believe, the kind of tension he was experiencing. My message, a strong message I received at home, was be responsible. Be responsible for other people. I had two younger brothers. Be responsible for your brothers. Be responsible for the world. Whenever we'd come home from a church event, we would always talk about how it could have been done better and what we needed to do to help it be done better the next time. We were responsible for everything that went on around us. Well, that that was a good motivator. I went on, I became a social worker, I became a pastor, and how responsible can you get? You know, here I was taking care of everybody and trying to make sure everybody's problems were worked out. Can you imagine the kind of stress that involves? And maybe you can, because many of us coming out of our church background have some of that message, where we feel like we're responsible for everybody and their issues and their problems. Well, it was quite a revelation to me that by my trying to be somebody, by being responsible for people, it was actually getting in the way of being loving and being a good counselor. And let me show you how. That when I felt a need, that if I was really going to be somebody, I had to be responsible for someone else, then I have to see other people as irresponsible. I have to look for their problems. And I have to relate to them, not as a person, but I have to relate to them in terms of their problems, in terms of how to help them solve their problems. And if they don't take my advice or use my help, and if they don't solve their problems, then maybe I'm not being responsible enough. It's a threat to me, so I need to manipulate them to try to get them to do things better. And in that sense, my trying to be responsible for people was both a very heavy experience for me, but it was also a manipulative way of relating to other people, and was not an effective way. In an ultimate way, I could say it was sinful, because it was not truly loving. Now, the nature of these is that this is what we often hear after we have the feeling that somehow we're not enough. As we're growing up as kids, and very early in life, we are anxious about whether we're going to be enough, whether we're going to have a place in this world, whether we're going to get taken care of, whether we're going to get recognized. And so, out of that anxiety, that fear that maybe we're nobody, we tune in and say, hey, Mom and Dad, what does it take to be somebody? And that gives some of the power to these messages. And that's why they become drivers. That's some of the power, my need to hurry up, my need to be responsible for people. Because it's in that way I think that maybe I'm finally going to be somebody. If only you will do this, you can be somebody. And notice the similarity to the temptations to Jesus. The devil comes to Jesus in the desert, and he says, hey, Jesus, if you really want to be somebody, if you are the Lord, then turn the bread or the stones into bread. If you really are the Lord, then prove it by making God take care of you. Cast yourself off and make his angels come and swoop you up. Now, if you really want to be somebody, Jesus, if only you want to be somebody, and if you can be somebody, if you only bow down to me, and I'll make you ruler over all the lands. And each time Jesus says, no way, I don't need that. He was perfectly ready to be who he was. He didn't feel the need to prove it. So the stress of these kinds of messages is finally the stress that Jesus is talking about in the text I read yesterday, when he said, which of you, by being anxious, can add one cubit to your span of life? Which of you, by being anxious, can make yourself more than you are? This then is what these are about. Now, what do we do? There's two steps, I believe, to being free of these. The first step, and I often am not able to share this with people, but like when I talk to business and industry groups, I'm not able to make clear to them this first step, but I think it's crucial. And that is, are you a nobody? How do you know you're not a nobody? How would you respond to that? How do you know you're not a nobody? That God made you? God made you you? God loves you and affirms you. He doesn't expect you to be Susie Q or Joe DiMaggio or anybody else. He wants you to be you. And it's that givenness of who we are that finally makes it possible to say, it's okay to be who I am. That doesn't mean I'm doing everything right. It only means that I am me, I can't be anybody else, so I can let go and start living as me and stop trying to be more than I am, because finally I can't be more than I am. It's that step, it's that that unhooks that basic anxiety. Jesus says it in another way. He says, hey, whoever of you would find your life, whoever you who are going to make sure you're somebody, you're going to lose it. Because you're going to try so hard that finally you're going to pay the penalty. You're going to pay it with stress, and you're going to pay it with wear and tear on yourself and the effect on others. But whoever will lose his life, who will ever give up his attempt to prove himself somebody, will find himself. Find himself as a child of God. Find his worth and his value and be able to let go of all that striving to prove oneself. When we begin to let go and give up the striving, then we can begin to look at some other ways of living life. Now for me, I call these allowers, also in TA is where I've gotten these, transactional analysis, these are called allowers. My hurry up. When I was hurrying up, I was tense, I was focused, my energy was in getting there, I would do everything I could to strain to try to get there fast, to try to get the job done. I wasn't very efficient in my whole body. My tension was making me less effective, even though I would work hard to hurry up. And I missed a very important point, and that is that I thought really living was getting to the goals, that you only were really alive when you felt you had accomplished something. And I missed enjoying the getting there. So it was a whole new way of looking at life when someone says, hey, enjoy the getting there. That you don't have to be locked in on the task. You can, like if I'm driving someplace, I can see what's around me. I can enjoy every moment of the task of reaching the goal. And it began to make a whole difference in the way I experienced life, in terms of letting go and enjoying what was happening now, as well as letting myself move toward the goal. And that doesn't mean that I can't move quickly. Notice the difference. I can move quickly without hurrying. I can move quickly without the striving. In fact, I can probably move more quickly if I'm not striving so hard to hurry up. There's a different quality to living life. The psalmist says it, run and not be weary. You can let go in a different way. And so, try hard. An allower would be, let yourself do it. In other words, let yourself do whatever it is. Don't just try hard to do it. Don't strain, but just let yourself do it. Have you known those people that get a job and they just kind of move and the job gets done? Kind of look, and they didn't make any big deal out of it. Others make a big production out of it. But they just let go and do it. Now, what would be an allower for a be perfect? What might be something that would be freeing to someone who had a be perfect driver?
Lower your expectations.
Lower your expectations, okay.
There's no. Do your best.
Just do your best, okay.
Mm-hmm. Be yourself.
Be yourself. Mm-hmm. My wife's grandfather had one. Anything that's worth doing is worth doing wrong. Now, I have a physician friend who says, boy, when I'm in surgery, he said, I better not make any mistakes. So one of them was, it's okay to make mistakes. He said, wait a minute now. I can't tell myself that when I'm in surgery. And so we had to talk about that. And what it says is, it's okay to risk making mistakes so that you can let go and do the job. It's like if you are so concentrated on not making mistakes because you're afraid that you won't be perfect and you won't be somebody. It's like trying to walk a plank, a thin 2x4, balancing yourself. And the more you focus hard on the 2x4 and making sure you don't fall off, the more you're likely to fall off. If you relax and you look out ahead and say, okay, I can do it, you can walk. Yes?
One thing I wanted to add here is that there's a lot of people too, or you hear a little bit about this, that have a real fear of success. You know, they strive very hard to be successful in everything that they do, but a lot of times, in some areas, I do too, I'm more afraid to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that puts, you know, you're kind of in this, like two magnets that are repelling each other. It's really kind of a strange thing, but it happens quite frequently.
So a lot of tension there where you almost reach the point of success and then you feel like you let go or you blow it in some way. Is that what you're saying?
Almost afraid to be successful.
Mm-hmm. So a real bind. One demand saying be successful and another one say don't you dare.
Mm-hmm.
You might take a look at how that got set up for you. In terms of what that might mean as a child, in terms of the family dynamics of what would your being successful, what effect would that have had on the whole situation? And that's because it's often useful to go back and say, how did I learn these things? And we begin to say, oh yeah, that made sense back then, but that doesn't need to be the way I live my life now. We begin to give ourselves permission. What would be some allowers for the be strong, don't feel? Paul has one. He says, my strength is made perfect in weakness. Begins to see that even in his weakness, he discovers his real strength. One is okay. It's okay to cry, and slowly we're learning that crying is a very useful mechanism, and that it's valid for men as for women, and that there's nothing that implies a lack of manliness about crying. It's a way of dealing with loss or grief, and it's a great release. Very valuable experience. Be responsible. What might be an allower for someone who has been told to be responsible? That finally you can't solve another person's problem. Mm-hmm. And we need to see it in the context, of course. And he was in the midst of the monastic movement where there was this strong emphasis upon be careful that you don't sin, which often meant pull into a cloister, don't get involved in the world, just pull back from the world and keep yourself from sin. And so it meant almost a do nothing but try to relate to God And what he was saying is, hey, you know, we have to get out there and live in the world. And that's probably going to mean sinning, but sin boldly in the sense of you live in the grace of God. Don't go out and sin intentionally, but don't let yourself stop living out of your attempt not to sin. That was more the context that he was giving us. Okay, let's get this one. How about a please me driver? That's an interesting one. What would you, if a person had a please me driver, what do you think would give help them to be free?
Please yourself.
Please yourself, okay.
It's okay to be me and fill my bucket.
It's okay to be me and fill my bucket. And you see the...
Do those people really want to change that?
Yes.
Yes, because often they feel like they're in a prison. They feel like they have no life of their own, often. That all their choices are made by someone else. So part of what they've gotten in growing up was that their rights are of no worth. They have no rights. It's the rights of others around them that they have to attend to. And so it's in that sense that I think Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, he's pointing to the importance of a balance here. That if you only are focused in doing everything for your neighbor and don't consider yourself, ultimately you're going to end up bitter and unloving. Because if you aren't considering yourself as well as your neighbor, in an ultimate sense, you're not making room in life for both of you.
There's two ways you can look at that. If you don't love yourself, how do you love your neighbor?
That's right. That's a good point. That ultimately you don't really love your neighbor, finally, if you don't love yourself. That implies loving both. And it's that kind of freeing the person then that feels so trapped that they have to please everybody else and never themselves, that they begin to see a new sense of way of being who they are and valuing themselves.
And we all have these things laid upon us, and we lay these things upon all the people around us. It is not that one person sits there sick because they have more be responsible around them. They just, maybe they have more, and two people could have the same amount of all of those put upon them. One would come out able to handle it, and one would feel burdened by one of those things. We all have it, and we all give it.
Now, there may be, you know, a person may have a please me, but that may have been balanced by also get, you know, do things for yourself. And if it's in balance, then it may be something that's working for a person. So if you are not feeling any stress or strain around some of these, if they feel like they're very relaxed and comfortable and a good way of working in life, then it probably is not a driver. Then you're probably using it in a constructive way with balance. It's more when these begin to be kind of a total orientation that drive us that we're faced with some problems. Any other questions about the drivers and allowers? Now, I've mentioned the allowers. The drivers were programmed into you repeatedly through experiences in childhood, and they often play without you being aware of it in your head. If you are going to give yourself an allower, you need to also put it into the computer, put it into your brain storage bank. And to do that, you need sometimes to use some techniques. One is that when you begin to feel a certain kind of stress, if you feel a hurry up, have a phrase you say to yourself, hey, enjoy the getting there. Hey, easy does it. And you say this to yourself. Now you might start forgetting that. One of the ways to begin doing that is as you wake up in the morning. Have a way of saying that to yourself, maybe including it in a prayer for the day. Lord, when I get going today, help me enjoy the getting there. And so repeat that prayer. Write a prayer for yourself and repeat it each morning. Now one of the reasons of doing it, when you wake up, right as you wake up, and just before you go to bed, is that you have often more access to your brain recording system because you're in your alpha brain state. When you're just waking up, your brain waves are moving slower and you have more access to the important recording system than you will after you get busy during the day. So don't wait until you're going full speed to try to program something in. Kind of do it when you're laying there and relaxed and thinking about what's today going to be like and play it into your system. That way we begin to change some of the programming with which we've grown up. We change our perspectives. Now there's, when you're in a situation where you're confronted with a threat or a demand, and you begin to feel yourself tensing up, you need at that point often to pause. When you feel the pressure's on, feel the heaviness. Now, you might have noticed that when a cat walks into a room, say of a group of people, it might walk into the center of the room, and what does it do? Licks its paws. It's like, when in doubt, lick. Well, I want to give you one. When in doubt, breathe. So when you're aware of yourself beginning to tense up, take a breath of air. That helps bring your attention and your awareness into yourself, and then begin to say, how do I want to approach this? And often there, it's helpful to change the way you're looking at something. For instance, if there's a particular person that you're anxious about meeting, change the way you see the person. Sometimes see the person as a child. And one woman shared her secret to success. She had to go around and work with men who were in positions of authority. And whenever she would come in and be with a man who was in authority, she would get very anxious. And so she experimented with things that worked for her. And the one she came up with, she said, I just see the man nude, and all of a sudden he's not a threat to me. Now, for others it might be a threat. But anyway, change your perspective. Change how you're looking at the situation. Be playful with it a little. That's one way. Now another way, you're about to do something and you're thinking, that kind of feeling, the tension, the striving, fearfulness, anxiety. A question you might ask is, what's the worst thing that can happen? You know, he'll say no. Or it won't work. Or ta-da-da-da. Or I might even lose my job, but I'll get another one. So often by saying, what's the worst thing that can happen, we begin to put things in perspective. And then we can say, okay, I can handle that. And we assure ourselves we can deal with what we're thinking of. Another way of doing that is, what difference will it make 5 years from now? Oh, this person might not like me. What difference will it make 5 years from now? See? Again, often with some perspective, we begin to let go. That's what I think yesterday I pointed out to you, that Jesus gives this long talk about anxiety. And what does he end up with? Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. To seek means, I believe, to let ourselves see. And so one of the ways of changing the framework of any situation that you're in is to see first the kingdom of God in that situation. Look at the situation. Now, if you did that, what were some of the things that you would see? If you saw a tense situation, in the context of the kingdom of God, how would that change the perspective?
God's love and that God is taking care of
us. Yeah, God's in charge.
And that we do not have to worry about it.
The outcome's already there, isn't
it?
Okay, and if we see first the kingdom of God, you can begin to see that she's working out her life. And she's needing to make goofs up for some reason. And what does it mean to work with her around her goofs up? And let her goof up maybe if she needs to, man, and relate to her as a person who at that point needs to goof up. Yeah, doesn't that change it in terms of seeing them differently? Yes.
And I think it gives that breathing.
And sees their worth. And maybe turning it on yourself, too. Hey, I am a child of God. They may not think anything of me right now. They may think I'm worthless, but God doesn't. Also, God is at work in any situation. So that I sense that what Jesus is saying is if we see first the kingdom of God and we begin to let go and sense the presence of God and the rule of God and the love of God, as you pointed to, that it can do a lot about how we experience our stress and our anxiety. It can change the way we experience any situation. I've been experimenting with it and having fun. It really makes me shift my thinking. That's so-and-so, look what he's trying to do to me. You know, oh, wait a minute. You know, what's his problem, what's mine, and how can we both live here? That's the other thing it does, is says, well, and we'll look at this tomorrow. It's not a matter of who's going to win. It's a matter that that kingdom is big enough for both of us, and how are we both going to be a part of that kingdom? And how am I going to see that, rather than trying to exclude him or feel like I have to be excluded? It deals with a lot of our issues. And so, the disciples and Jesus went out in the boat to talk about stress. And it says that the storm came up and the disciples come to Jesus and says, "Save, Lord, we are perishing." And Jesus said, "Why are you afraid, O men of little faith?" I believe that the deepest perspective that we can have to deal with our stress in life is gaining a sense of what it means to live with a faith, trust, and belief in God. And then beginning to see life in that sense. And I believe that it not only changes what we see, but as we let go of our striving, we open up to the tremendous capacities that we have as people. And I sense that's what Jesus was saying is, hey, you people, you who have eyes to see, why don't you see? Ears to hear, why don't you hear? Why don't you let yourself go? If you have faith, greater works than I do, will you do? That Jesus is inviting us to let go of all the striving so that we can open up our capacities. And in that sense, find that life can be much less stressful in the day-to-day task. Our Christian faith is a major and tremendous resource for how to live life in a very stressful and a very rapidly changing world, and I believe can be the source of maintaining our health and our vitality for a long life. And so it's my fascination with exploring more and more what that can be about for us.